This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer. It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. Great to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. It's an interesting time when you open an email and get a genuine shock by what you find. And that's what happened when we saw the survey findings from some research carried out by Volkswagen and Road Safety UAE. Why do parents, despite knowing the dangers of not putting their kids in car seats and using seatbelts, continue with this behaviour? This is what we were looking at in light of the fact that 40% of parents don't buckle up their kids. They're saying it's because their kids don't like it. Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE was on hand, along with Dr. Saliha from Lighthouse Arabia, to really dig into this behaviour, and we were hearing your opinions too. Now, about 2 years ago, we had Sophie Madad on the line. She was sharing her experience, her struggles with an eating disorder. And it was such a pleasure when we heard from her to say how well she's doing. So, of course, we invited her back to explain what she's been going through over the last year or so and continuing to fight that eating disorder, even in light of a global pandemic. And we had Dr. Willie joining us from Priory Wellbeing Centre to answer your questions and indeed concerns around disordered eating and obsessive exercise. And staying with our psychology theme, from Thrive Wellbeing Centre, who was on hand to discuss the alarming rise in self-harm. In uncertain times, people have different coping mechanisms, and the reported case of self-harm in young children, even though as young as primary age, has shocked the industry. We were talking about why people do it, and ultimately, if you are a concerned parent or friend, how you can broach the subject without forcing that person into hiding that behaviour even further. And we were turning our attentions to one inspirational young man, a student here in Dubai, who is packing his bags and going to the Sahara. Young Younoua is heading off to take on the Marathon de Sable, 250 kilometres of desert running. He was explaining why he was doing it and what he's hoping to get out of it. Don't forget, we are live on your radio Sunday afternoons, 2 to 5 UAE time, discussing children's health, education and parenting. Please do share this podcast with anyone you feel would find it useful.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, Volkswagen has recently conducted a survey around car safety in partnership with Road Safety UAE and addressing three concerns around safety: managing stress and anxiety on the road, and we're speaking to psychologists in half an hour's time, child safety and journey preparation. And the results might shock you. Joining us to explain this and more, Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE. Thomas, thank you for being with us this afternoon. I saw this study and had an almost visceral reaction, which was like, I'm so sick of talking about car seats in 2021. Why are we still having this conversation?
Good afternoon.
Can you tell I'm a little bit passionate about this topic? Can you explain, outline some of the main findings from your safety survey with VW?
Yeah, Helen, I mean, as you just said, it's all about being passionate about this topic. And I've been passionate about that for a long time. I'm a father, and I think when you're a caring parent, of course, you do just not understand why there are still people out there who obviously don't get the message. Even more so, because since 2017, it is the law that we have to buckle up our kids. Mm-hmm. Still, about a third of people say, you know what, I do not have a child seat. Yes, I have a kid between the age of 0 to 4. But the law mandates the use of a child seat. But you know what? A third of people say, sorry, I don't even have a child seat. And that's a little bit scary.
So have you been surprised by this most recent survey? As I said, you're obviously a passionate advocate for this and have been some time. Do you feel like attitudes have changed, or have these numbers perhaps shine a light on the fact that they haven't really changed at all?
Yes, this is sad. And this is the reason also why Volkswagen stepped up and they approached us and they asked us if we wanted to refresh some of the market studies that we have done earlier. Because, you know, interestingly enough, we researched that issue before the introduction of the holistic seatbelt law, as I mentioned earlier, 2017 and after. And there just seems to be no movement. So people still don't get it. So even if there is a law in place, people don't get it. And this one third of people who say, you know, we don't have a proper child car seat in place is alarming. But, you know, even these people who do have child seats, about 40% don't buckle up their kids always.
And interestingly, the reasoning behind that was what really shocked me. 40% of parents said their kids are not buckled up because they don't like being strapped in. This is what I find really challenging because, in honesty, and we're going to be talking to a psychologist after 5:30 about this, being a parent doesn't always mean being liked. being a parent means sometimes you do things for them, which are good for them, that they will not enjoy. And car seat safety, I think, is a really good example of that. And I know how stressful it is. I know when they're arching their back and trying to kick you, and it's really, really tough. But we will be exploring this, with Dr. Saha after 3:30 today. Thomas, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the law. What are the kind of fines and legal repercussions if you do not buckle up your child, as you said, at 0 to age 4 in a car seat?
Yeah, basically, it's 400 dirhams per person that's not buckled up and 4 black points. So it's serious. And the authorities introduced this law for a reason. Mm-hmm. So road traffic accidents remain the number one cause of life years lost. So this means a lot of young people, including children, are losing their lives on the roads. So it's not a joke. So this is the reason why the authorities implemented this law on 1st of July of 2017. But again, I think it's going deeper. It's not only the law that will help to change the situation. It is about entities, stakeholders like ARN, like the leading media in the UAE, like responsible companies like Volkswagen, to come up and to continuously educate parents, to continuously underline the importance of protecting our children. And as you just said, it's not about being a friend and being a playmate for our children all the time. It's also about really being a parent and
keeping them
alive. To guide our children.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's also about creating habits. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, maybe the first time the child doesn't like it, but as soon as the child sees every time we are hopping in the car, he or she gets buckled up, they will get used to that. And my own son, Oliver, I mean, the odd occasion where we forgot to buckle him in, he said, "Ah, Papa, you forgot something." And I think this is it. It's about habit creation.
Absolutely.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE is live on the line. We will be getting a psychologist online in about 10 minutes' time to discuss a new survey that has come out. Automotive brand VW, in conjunction with Road Safety UAE, conducted this survey with some pretty alarming findings. 84% of UAE motorists face anxiety or stress while on the road. I actually think it probably should be higher. 40% of parents said that their kids are not buckled up because they don't like being strapped in. And 82% of correspondents believe that they would drive more safely if they left their destination 10 minutes earlier. Thomas with us this afternoon to unpick this and take your questions as well. And Thomas, a really good question here actually from Chris saying, do the public have the right to report anyone breaking the law if they see a child on a parent's lap in the front seat, for example?
Yes, of course we do. Police, they open several channels of communication to the public. One of those is called We Are All Police. So you can report all instances to police. There are a lot of other interfaces into Abu Dhabi police, into Dubai police, into the other polices in the Emirates. They all have a very strong online presence, and we can drop them notes. We can report other motorists where we feel they are not driving responsibly. They are not taking care of the children appropriately. Absolutely, this is possible.
Okay, really hope that helps, Chris and anyone else out there who wants to do their bit. I wanted to turn to one of the other findings about leaving 10 minutes earlier. Can you explain a little bit about the psychology around that and what impact you would have if you think we all did it? I would love to do that. I've just got a lot of stuff going on, Thomas.
Yeah. We did other pieces of research over the years, and ARN published all of those pieces of research. And when we asked people about speeding, so why are you speeding? Number one reason was because I'm running late. In another piece of research, we asked people about tailgating. So why do you tailgate? Number one reason, because we are running late. And this is it's a dangerous trend. So that's the reason why we wanted to zoom in with Volkswagen specifically on the issue of time management. And then we figured out, you know, that 84% of people say, you know what? Yeah, actually, we feel much safer if you would leave earlier. Mm-hmm. Yes, our stress levels would go down. Yes, our likeliness to speed or to tailgate would go down tremendously. Now, you are asking the right question. So what is holding us back? What really holds us back when you think about it?
I know what the answer is, Thomas. It's lack of planning on my part. It's getting up 10 minutes earlier. But I think yes, there is that preparation and that time buffer. But I also think there's a big issue of the psychology of driving as well, and how some people actually really enjoy, you know, flashing their ego around and feeling like they're winning on the road and overtaking. And, you know, this is, yeah, ego. I think it comes back to an awful lot of the time, especially when I think of tailgating, which can be so intimidating. And I'm not surprised when we see that stat about 84% of people feeling stressed or having anxiety on the roads, because sometimes you get out in the morning or the afternoon and you think there is a mood on the road. This doesn't feel safe. There's this clown over here, and there's this person who I can see is weaving and going slowly, and look, they're on their phone. And you pick up on this mood. That's the only way I can describe it, where you feel lucky to get to your destination because you feel like something's going to happen. And we're addressing this afternoon. Psychologist Salahi joining us after 3:30 this afternoon. Thomas Rennie wants to look into the survey that you conducted with Volkswagen more in depth. Where can people find that data?
Well, it's on our portal. It's on roadsafetyue.com. We have a specific segment which is called Statistics. So we are featuring all of our pieces of research there, and also third-party research that we come across. So people can always refer to this piece of information. It was also published nicely by the media, by the leading print media in the last couple of days. So I think it's really great that we have companies like Volkswagen joining the bandwagon, mm-hmm. taking on their role as responsible citizens and helping us to improve the situation by raising awareness.
Well, thank you for spearheading a lot of this research. And as I said, I was shocked, and I'm very interested to speak next to Dr. Salaha about some of the reasons she hears from parents about not buckling up their kids. Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE. Thank you for your time, sir. Have a wonderful afternoon ahead.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Really interesting to get your take on this, guys. We've been speaking to Thomas Edelman from Road Safety UAE about a survey they did in conjunction with Volkswagen. And in honesty, when I saw the email, my jaw did kind of drop. In some aspects, some of those findings, not that surprising. 84% of UAE motorists face anxiety or stress while on the road. Genuinely surprised it's not higher. 82% of correspondents believe they would drive more safely if they left for their destination 10 minutes earlier. But this is the one that I'm really zoning in on this afternoon. 40% of parents said that their kids are not buckled up because they don't like being strapped in. We will be speaking to Dr. Salaha very soon to understand the psychology of that. And Hilary is saying it's almost impossible to leave. There could even be a question about buckling up in 2021. Mika is saying, my wife and I are expecting our first. I very much plan to use a car seat. In fact, if anyone wants to get rid of one, hit me up, ? There you go, 4001, if you can hook Mika up. Rowan, thank you for this, saying, if my autistic child can buckle up, there is no excuse for everyone else's children. Hint, incentives. A cookie or an M&M will get any kid into a car seat. Yeah, you're speaking my language. It's my parenting strategy all over. Empty threats and bribery. Here's Kirsty sharing her thoughts.
In relation to car seats, absolutely non-negotiable. My children are now 21 and 18 and a half, so long past car seats, but it was an absolute non-negotiable rule. If they were in a car, if they traveled in a car, they were in a car seat, a booster seat, a seatbelt. Interestingly enough, my son is now a driver himself, and shockingly, he will tell me, going with friends, some of them laugh when he gets in the car and puts his seatbelt on and says, oh, what happened? Are you afraid? I'm grateful that I've instilled that in them, and that we took having car seats as an absolute non-negotiable part of parenting. If you choose to have a child, if you choose to carry a child in a car, they have to be in a car seat.
Thank you for that, Kirsty. And here's Claudia sharing her thoughts and experiences.
I'm really passionate about this, having to pick up your children. And I think there are many reasons why parents don't do it. And I think some of them, as I see it, is that, you know, the thought is, well, when I was a child, I was never buckled up and look, I'm okay. Another might be parents are so permissive. And when their child fights being buckled up, they will just say, well, okay, don't worry, you don't need to be buckled up. Another reason might be that, oh, mommy, daddy, the nanny, granny, whoever, will be able to hang on to that child during an accident. And we know that that is physically not possible. But people don't realize that when you actually are in a head-on collision or in some kind of collision, that you will not be able to hold that child. And I think people are just maybe lazy or just plain naive when it comes to child safety. And it really, really upsets me. And I actually get really quite angry when I see people driving around with the children standing on the back seat or sitting on the front seat or sitting on someone's lap. And to the degree that when I was still living at home in South Africa a couple of years ago, they also introduced this law that up till age 3, kids had to be buckled in. And back home also, a lot of people don't buckle their children in, probably for the same reasons. So I organized a talk at school, and they came and presented, because you thought if even just a few kids say, Mom, don't forget to buckle me up, I think we've done a good job. Plus, we could collect car seats for those who can't afford them, and they get refurbished, cleaned up, and we collected many, many car seats in our school for little babies, and it was fantastic. So that's how I feel about buckling up your children. Thank you.
Oh, Claudia, thank you so much for that. Really, really appreciate it. Lillian saying, I see this a lot at nursery drop-off, parents just putting their kids in the back with no car seat or seatbelt. I spoke to a dad once who was really defensive and rude. I wish the nursery could enforce this. Does raise an interesting point, the role of nurseries and schools in enforcing this at drop-off and pick-up. As Thomas from Road Safety UA highlighted earlier, this is the law. So you're talking 400 dirham fine for everyone in that car who's not buckled up, and 4 black points as well. And we had a question from Chris saying, you know, what rights or responsibilities do the public have to report this? And yes, you absolutely can. The police have set up channels there. Daisy's saying, we travel a lot with our children. When we were in rural India, we were looked at very strangely for bringing the car seats along. Just one example, I can't speak for larger cities, but no one used car seats. They simply weren't educated on it. Nothing makes me more angry than seeing a baby or child not strapped in. I thought it was mandatory to show a car seat when leaving the hospital, but apparently that's no longer the case. And Haki's saying, 100% mandatory for as long as possible. They don't have to like it. It's just like toothbrushing, but they have to do it. All kids travelling in my car must be in a car seat if their age or size requires it. Full stop. They've only just come out of their high back boosters, age 7 and 10, when they reached the weight limit, and now in regular boosters with the right level for the shoulder strap. It's the one topic I'm absolutely militant about. When I was first pregnant, we got news that one of my husband's colleagues had been killed in a tragic car accident on Sheikh Zayed Road. I believe a car had flipped over. Her 2-year-old boy was safely strapped into his car seat at the time and was totally fine. It's always stayed with me, and I still think about it often when driving with my kids. Thank you for that.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Unpicking a recent survey this hour that Volkswagen recently conducted with Road Safety UAE, an advocate for responsible and safe driving here, addressing three main concerns around road safety: managing stress and anxiety on the roads, child safety, and journey preparation. 82% of correspondents believed that they would drive more safely, so not speeding, not tailgating, if they left their destination 10 minutes earlier. 84% of UA motorists face anxiety or stress while on the road. I want to know, what do you other 16% do to keep your stress levels down? Please share your secrets with me. And 40% of parents said that their kids are not buckled up because they don't like being strapped in. Clinical psychologist and managing director of Lighthouse Arabia, Dr. Saleha, joining us on the line now. Saleha, I genuinely want to understand this. Can you explain some of the psychological reasoning as to why so many parents choose not to strap their children in car seats despite knowing that it keeps them safe?
Hi, Helen.
Hi.
You know, this is a great question. I think there's a few elements that I'd like to discuss here. One is that generally parents are stressed and they don't want to deal with the conflict that perhaps arises with buckling children up. Perhaps they are coming from countries or just their own upbringing where that just wasn't a normal practice. And to be honest, majority of the world, it is not a common practice to have children buckled up. So there does need to be a lot more awareness of the importance of buckling children up. And so the lower adoption rate of having children buckled up in their car seats is probably a result of low awareness, but then also this high stress moment where you're trying to get kids in and you're running late. And so parents are just usually feeling quite stressed and they don't know how to regulate that stress in order to develop some of these habits. Mm-hmm. And we know from change psychology and habit psychology that human beings will always gravitate towards what is easier and less stressful. We all know that working out is good for us, but not everyone is going to engage in that. It's because we will gravitate and we are committed to keeping our life easier and will not want to struggle. And I think there's just a lot of stressed out parents who are just not having these boundaries in place with their children.
I find it baffling. I really do. But as you say, I think that's to do with education. And I grew up in a time, you know, the 80s, where it was all about, you know, clink, clack, clack, you know, putting your seatbelt on in the back and it becoming, as you say, that habit of your hand going back and buckling up. And I've often been like, have I put my keys, my car seat? Yeah, I did because my seatbelt, because I just do it. I get in, I turn on the engine, I put it on, and I don't even realise. Much like we're getting with mask wearing now. I'm like, am I wearing a mask? Oh yeah, I put it on, I didn't realise. But if that hasn't been ingrained in you from childhood or teenage years or early years, it is a concerted effort. And I really hope this conversation isn't coming off as scolding. What I find really interesting is the number of messages that we're getting from people in total agreement. And that's what I find frustrating. If I put something on my social media about this, if we talk about it on air, I feel like we're almost not getting through to the people that need to hear it most, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, because I feel like, especially on my Instagram, it's something of an echo chamber. People that follow me are most likely going to have quite similar views to me. So it feels a bit, I feel a bit impotent talking about it, to be honest, sometimes. I want to go to the text line, Doctor. Andy's saying, parents who don't secure their kids into car seats are irresponsible and bad examples of parenting. It's a form of child abuse. I manage school parking at Safford Community School last 5 years, and this is what infuriates me, as does parents talking on their phone with unrestrained kids. Yet the parents wear their safety belts, go figure. That is such an interesting point, because I see the same thing. You're driving, yet your kids are bouncing around, or, you know, baby on dashboard rather than baby on board. So why do it for you but not for your kids? No name on this one saying, absolutely not negotiable for me too, and now my toddler won't let me move if he's not buckled. Although when I was in my home country, my in-laws couldn't understand it, especially when everyone is going on an outing together and I insist on taking two cars because of the car seats. Luckily in Dubai, even our nursery enforces it. And Sonia, thank you for this, saying, I think better education on what happens upon impact when you're holding a child would help. Videos of car crashes with crash test dummies should be on primetime ads and billboards everywhere. It does my head in to not see kids strapped in. And Anna, blowing my mind on 4001, saying, here's a new one. I'm getting to be very common in Ras Al Khaimah. Nanny shuttling two kids on an electric bike or scooter, all with no helmets or vests. Parents get aggressive or just ignore when questioned. Don't they care, or do they want them dead? What a weird world we live in. Anna, trust me, electric scooters are a topic for another show. I need an hour to rant about those. Salia, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about how, I mean, message there about the in-laws not really understanding. How do you suggest that friends or concerned, you know, family can broach this subject with someone who inherently just doesn't agree with them on the safety aspect of this?
I think this is where, when you are sure and committed to your stance, people know that this is a non-negotiable. These are firm, non-negotiable boundaries that you are drawing. This is about, this is a life or death matter. This is not, this just looks good and it's like the, a fashion trend these days. So I think when you take a stance like that and be prepared, for example, the person who had two cars that they needed, be prepared for whatever you need to do in order to make that journey work. Because there are, I can tell you about my home country where, you know, some of these things are not necessarily practices. I will need to be ready with whether it's an Uber car or whether it's my own car or whether it's me renting a car to make sure that I drive safely. Mm-hmm. So once you show that level of commitment and they realize that this is a non-negotiable, be ready to hear their criticism, but let it bounce off of you because you yes. remember your why.
Exactly.
When you remember
exactly
your why,
it.
It doesn't really affect you as much.
I want you to come back to your point about stressed parents and that being a real pain point, really, for not wanting to face that the stress of having a confrontation with your kids. And as I said earlier, kids are strong. They might be small, but they will arch their back. They will kick you. You know what? And until you get past that and it becomes a habit, it can really set the tone for a day. And I understand why parents would shy away from that. And I just wondered if you're able to offer any advice on that regulation of emotions from a parent so they can be calm in that moment, keep an eye on the bigger picture, and as you so correctly said, remember their why.
So just like we engage with toilet training or we engage with, you know, feeding them solids or getting them off the bottle, this is one of those things that we have to think about in the terms of behavioral modification. Whenever you are trying to modify a behavior, you can expect that the child will push your boundaries. If you know that you are trying to do this, then you want to be in a total, like, calm state. You want to be relaxed. You want to do your yoga, meditation, whatever it is before you engage. Because that's kind of what the mindset we go into toilet training with, right? We're like, for 10 days or 2 weeks or 1 month, that this is my life is going to revolve around this because I've got to get this kid trained. Mm-hmm. And we have to get our kids trained with car seats. And that is going to require that level of commitment, that level of zen, and know that anytime you are modifying a behavior, there will be something called an extinguishing burst, like a burst. And that's going to be a burst of behavior that is going to absolutely escalate. And they will be screaming and shouting, but you don't give in at that point. That's exactly when the behavior is going to get extinguished, because they're going to realize, the child will realize, that no matter what they do, this is something that is a non-negotiable. And at that point, the behavior will change. But usually what happens, Helen, is that parents give out during the extinguishing burst moment and they say, okay, fine, just do whatever you want. And that becomes the new norm. That if I scream that loud, my mom is going to give in. That's precisely when you don't give in and you hold. And you realize that any behavior you've seen, they dress themselves, they do all these things themselves. This is just like any other behavior change you're trying to sort of condition them to.
Dr. Salia, thank you so much. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I know it's easy in theory when someone's listening today in their car at home and going, yeah, that's what I need to do next. I'm in the moment. It's so much harder. But finding that why, focusing on the bigger picture, that being a parent doesn't always mean being liked by your kids, but ultimately doing what's best by them and, you know, avoiding some pretty hefty fines as you go, is absolutely worth it. Thank you so, so much for your time today. You can, of course, be found with your colleagues at Lighthouse Arabia. We are
family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On Sundays, we talk about young people's health, we talk about education, we talk about parenting, and I'm really honoured to welcome back a guest that joined us last year to talk about her own battle with eating disorders. Sophie Madad is joining us now on Microsoft Teams, and she spoke so bravely and eloquently about what she was going through, and it's a real honour to have her back on the show. You're not in Dubai anymore, Sophie, where are you?
No, I actually moved to Australia around 2 months ago.
Well, how's it going?
It's going really well. I really like it here.
Good. Well, thank you so much for joining us, because you're a guest whose story has really, really stayed with me. Not just because I loved meeting you, but how well you seemed to understand what you were going through and really appreciated the help that was around you from your family, but also from experts here in Dubai as well. And I have often wondered, and I thought, like, should I email her dad and see how she is? And I didn't want to push. And then when he messaged me, I thought, do you know what? If it stayed with me, I'm sure your truthful words and vulnerability and bravery, as I said, have really stayed with other people. So I'm genuinely interested to hear how you're getting on. But before we get to 2021, can you take us back a few years? And anyone who didn't hear our chat originally, When did you suspect that your attitude towards food was perhaps cause for concern, Sophie?
So it was probably around 2018, in June, and I started to cut out like sweet foods, and I started wanting to exercise more and just become a bit skinnier. And I didn't like notice this behavior. It was more my mom noticing it, and I just thought it was normal. And then as time like progressed, the eating disorder got worse.
And how bad did it get?
So it got to the state where I ended up in hospital, and a lot of concerns were out because I wasn't doing well and I didn't see it. So yeah, that was around 2019.
So fast forward then to 2021, and I'm guessing because your dad got in touch that you've turned something of a corner. What is your kind of health and I mean physical and mental health like now, Sophie?
It's honestly so much better. I'd 100% say that I'm back to normal now, and there's no like triggering or eating disorder thoughts going on in my head anymore. And my health is perfectly fine. I go to the gym when I feel like it, and if I feel like having something like a sweet treat or something, I'll go for it, and there's no fear, no shame.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We spoke to Sophie, my dad, a number of months ago about what she'd been through, her eating disorder struggle, and she spoke so bravely and eloquently. And she's back joining us today on the line from Australia, where she moved just a few months ago, to give us an update and to share some insights too. Can you tell us a little bit about what treatment looked like for you, Sophie, as you were going through this disordered eating and even, you know, obsessive exercising as well? How did you start to tackle it?
So, firstly, my mom took me to a dietitian and was trying to set me up with a meal plan. But unfortunately, my eating disorder was too strong and I was not listening to the meal plan, so it only got worse. And so the dietitian then assigned me to a psychologist. And I think I went to see her maybe once or twice every week. And then she did realize it was getting worse, so I was then sent to a doctor as well. And then was put in the hospital and then came out and did treatment once every week.
And then what do you think? That's what I was going to say, this talk therapy. What do you think changed in you or external factors that has got you through to the other side of this?
So it was more about listening to what other people had to say, because I was very trapped in my own thoughts. Well, they weren't even mine. And I really had to just block those thoughts out and listen to what other people had to say. And my psychologist had a really good point about incentives and what I should look forward to in the future so that I can battle this eating disorder and push through.
I think what's really important to note is that, you know, I kind of said pushing through the other side of this as if this is a chapter that's closed. And this is something that's probably going to be part of your life in some way for the rest of your life. And it's going to be a case of being aware of that. It would be naive to say that, you know, you are cured and, you know, this is, it's a happy ending. This is going to be something that you need to be mindful of, in all aspects of your life. And unfortunately, we have seen a rise in eating disorders over the course of the pandemic and people using disordered eating, obsessive exercise as a way of coping during really uncertain times. And the fact that you've managed to even get better during that time is just incredible, incredible testimony to you and those around you. If any parents are listening today and they're worried about someone in their life, their child, their teen, what advice would you have?
I would just say take them to see a psychologist as soon as possible, because they do say things that really will help you and make you hear things that you couldn't hear yourself. So.
Mm-hmm. And what are your hopes for the future? Yeah. Are you're in high school now in Australia. What's the plan?
Yeah, so I actually would love to become a psychologist when I'm older, because I love talking about this topic and would hope to help people out.
I think in honesty, it takes people like you to have these conversations. You know, we hear all the stats all the time about, you know, the numbers, but it's the stories, it's the people behind those numbers that really bring them to life and make you understand that this can happen to anyone and that there is help out there. Yeah. It just, you know, it was your mum that was able to recognise that, you know, there was something going on there, and, you know, absolute credit to your relationship that you've been able to go through this together. And Sophie, thank you so, so much to you and your family for keeping us updated. I think you've got such a wonderful future ahead of you, and my goodness, the amount of empathy you have and have developed because of this, you'll be an incredible psychologist. So maybe we'll have you back on the show in years to come as Dr. Sophie. But no, all the very best to you. So pleased and so proud that everything's going so well, and you've got those people in your life to turn to when the going does get tougher, you know, because we know that life's not perfect. There will be ups and downs, but if you've got other ways of coping, you're going to be amazing. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We heard from Sophie Madad earlier. She joined us on the show about a year or so ago talking about her eating disorder, her obsessive exercising, recognised by her mum, and is now living in Australia. And I was so delighted when her dad got in touch and said, Sophie's in a really good place and wants to tell people. And I think that's so valuable that we hear these stories of treatment and coming through and awareness and asking for help. Joining us live on the line now is consultant psychiatrist Dr. Waleed Ahmed. He's from Priory Wellbeing Centre in Abu Dhabi, and he is, well, so highly respected, senior consultant, 18 years of experience, and a member of the Royal College of Psychiatrists in the UK. He does have a special interest in eating disorders and has worked as a consultant at Priory's Special Inpatient Unit for Adults in Glasgow. He's joining us on the line now to share some insights. Dr. Waleed, thank you for being with us today. How are you?
I'm all right, Helen. How are you?
I am well, thank you. I'm feeling very positive hearing Sophie's story about coming through, because I actually feel like we very rarely hear these, and I'm reluctant to say recovery stories, because as I said to her, you're never going to say to someone who's had disordered eating, you are cured. This is something she's going to be living with for the rest of her life in some capacity. But to hear about treatment being effective, to hear about her swapping her coping mechanisms for stress and anxiety from, you know, restricting eating to whatever's working for her now. Can I ask you a strange question? Can I ask you, why is this your specialist interest? What kind of captures your attentions and imaginations and obviously years of research around disordered eating?
Absolutely wonderful question. So I actually got into eating disorder research and treatment quite later in my career, actually, to be honest. And that's because I've been seeing lots of adolescents and teenagers in sort of generic adolescent units with all sorts of problems like depression and psychosis, but lots of people with eating disorders and lots of young people eating disorders. And I got very curious, and it's not something that we, you know, to focus much on training, and this is all through experience. And I was so fascinated, and I went into the research and looked at, you know, treatment modalities and the genetics, the kind of etiology, the kind of causes for eating disorders. And I was excited about, you know, what could be done. And this is an area where you could actually help quite a lot of people in various stages of recovery. And recovery, as you said, is possible at any stage, you know, even if you're suffering from disordered eating for a long period of time. You know, I think it's important to stress that recovery is possible at any stage. And I think just meeting with families and patients and hearing their story just got me, very excited. And I went to adult eating disorders, and that's when, I got into the Priory eating disorder sort of treatment and the clinic there.
Dr. Reed, you mentioned there kind of causes, risk factors for certain patients. And what do we know about how, let's say, to young women, because that does tend to be the stereotypical image of someone who has an eating disorder, to young women who might have had similar backgrounds, similar, you know, parents, privilege, resources, under similar amounts of stress to do with school or societal factors, social media, friendship, why might one turn to disordered eating as a way of coping in their mind with their circumstances?
So one thing we need to probably, you know, it's sort of the elephant in the room kind of a thing, where nature versus nurture kind of discussion always takes place. What we have to recognize is that, you know, eating disorders is more frequent, more prevalent in families where there is a history of eating disorders in the family. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, there is any kind of you know, attribution to blame or anything like that. That people, you know, we all have different histories. We are rich with different kind of strengths and difficulties. And sometimes you could have people with sort of links, genetic risk factors that can make one person perhaps maybe more vulnerable to develop eating disorders than other people. But largely, actually, what the greatest influence is all about, you know, people's development. When young people, children develop, they journey their own life journeys, and they face, you know, traumas, they might face stress, and their own personalities come into play, where, as you said, disordered eating is a way of coping. It's not about food, it's not about weight per se. It's about how some people may use you know, eating and as a way of coping, or rather disordered eating as a way of coping. So things like you know, so low self-esteem, and people, if they suffer from depression, if someone has already another mental illness like anxiety. Anxiety is so prevalent in eating disorders, and that causes maybe additional stress for one person compared to another person in similar circumstances. Puberty, again, I mean, lots of young people developing sort of more preoccupation eating and their self-image around puberty time, lots of hormones kind of changes. Social pressure. Now, our young people at this, you know, this age, you know, face lots of pressure on social media and exposure to, you know, kind of lots of pressure and performing and being able to be accepted in society. And that might, if someone's more into social media and more into maybe projecting themselves mm-hmm. in that way, perhaps maybe one might be more vulnerable to such mm-hmm. kind of vulnerabilities as in developing an eating disorder.
Dr. Louis Walid is with us this afternoon. He is there at Priory in Abu Dhabi, as a consultant psychiatrist, and here to offer any insights, any help to anyone who's got in touch. And well, let's go to the text line now, Dr. Walid. John's saying, okay, please excuse my ignorance, but just an honest question. Is overeating also considered to be an eating disorder? I think that's a really good question. It's not ignorant at all. I think, there, as I said, it's that stereotypical image of, you know, a young girl suffering with anorexia, but it can be binge eating, overeating, purging, young, old, male, female. You know, there's a huge range in terms of severity and different types, I'm guessing, Dr. Walid.
Yeah, absolutely. And eating disorders, I mean, more than about 80% of people who suffer from eating disorders will probably be of a normal to average weight. And the question about overeating, we all, you know, have moments of overeating, and we might indulge ourselves, and that's kind of normal. We choose to do that at some time, and we usually have control over it, and we are quick to kind of recognize that. But people who suffer from eating disorders, they almost lose control of that. So, for example, in a condition like bulimia, where there is binge eating episodes, and these binge eating episodes are different from what one would say normal sort of overindulging. These episodes can be quite distressing for the sufferer, and they can almost lose control. They get disconnected, and they eat large, I mean, I'm telling you, large quantities of food in a very short space of time. And once they've done that, obviously, then people feel, or sometimes feel guilty, and often compensate for that. And that's when some of the compensatory kind of mechanisms kick in. And some people might maybe vomit, or what's called purging behaviors. Some people might overexercise just to compensate. Or some people might use things like laxatives, which can be quite deadly in some cases.
Dr. Lude, I'm going to keep you with us until 3 o'clock. We have had a number of messages, including parents really just asking for help. One who is concerned about her daughter, and another anonymous who is an anorexia sufferer herself who doesn't want to pass her insecurities onto her children. I also want to read this out from Al, who's been in touch, saying, having had a sister who had anorexia for 10 years and put our family through hell, I've got no sympathy. It's all about attention seeking. They're willing to seek psychological help and get more attention, but not put food in their mouth. It is a massive con. Dr. Lead, what would you say to that? Al, obviously coming from a place here where he's had firsthand experience.
Yeah, so I think eating disorders generally, you know, is grossly sort of misunderstood illness. And it's not, you know, any fault of anybody else. I mean, the media sometimes projects it in a way that you know, may suggest that it's a lifestyle choice or something in someone's control. But actually, you know, eating disorders, anorexia, bulimia, you know, binge eating disorders, they are very much sort of biological brain-based illnesses. And I think one of the first things that someone could do to help somebody who know, you know, they know has an eating disorder is to not blame anybody for it. It's not their fault. And often parents maybe listening to this, you know, maybe take some solace. It's not your fault either. It's mm-hmm. no one's fault. And these are kind of various factors coming together as causing this illness, like any other illness, physical or mental, for that young person. So I would first of all say that, you know, obviously, you know, being somebody in the field and speaking to hundreds, if not thousands, of patients and carers, you know, this is not something that one brings on to themselves. And I think blaming somebody is not going to be helpful.
I think what Al's point really does highlight, though, is how difficult it can be for family and friends around that person. You know, it's not just them suffering. It is the frustration of not being able to understand, not being able to control behaviour and not get someone that you love back to a healthy state through sheer will alone.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Very lucky to have stolen away Dr. Waleed Ahmed, consultant psychiatrist at Priory Wellbeing Centre in Abu Dhabi, to answer my questions and indeed yours around eating disorders. We heard earlier from Sophie, who is recovering from an eating disorder that she suffered from a number of years and is doing really, really well now. No name on this message, Dr. Waleed saying, I developed an eating disorder throughout quarantine and relapsed in November. Started active recovery in July a few months ago, and I can tell you I'm the happiest I've ever been. My anorexia made me hate everything and I was so out of it. I've started going to therapy and can finally eat without having panic attacks. I'm so, so glad. There is another side, a happy one, and I'm so proud of you, Sophie. Thank you for sharing that. It does raise the question, Dr. Waleed, about the pandemic and impact on mental health and how that has sometimes and some people manifested through disordered eating, trying to have some control over a really uncertain situation.
Absolutely. And you couldn't have a conversation these days without mentioning the pandemic. And I think the pandemic has uncovered a greater pandemic of mental health problems. You know, I think we all have gone through a period of, where we've seen our lives course on its own, and we lost control over some of our things that we were used to, our routines, and this has had a very negative impact on especially people with mental health conditions and with anorexia as well. We've noticed in the UK, when the first lockdown happened, where services shut down, and some of our patients we just kind of lost track of. And after the first lockdown, we had seen, unseen levels of eating disorders and level of eating disorders as well. They're quite severe, very low BMI patients. And it was recognized by the Royal College and also the eating disorder societies and the charities that more had to be done especially for these kind of patients. So the pandemic definitely has had a very negative impact on people who already suffered from disordered eating.
Not helped, I'm sure, by all the memes and jokes about people gaining weight during the pandemic or conversely other people being super productive and doing like a 2-hour at-home workout and shouting about it every day. You know, there's, kind of strange parallels.
And the public absolutely. And public messaging around, healthy eating has not helped this population. Has made the focus more acute on shape of the body and what you're eating, and that's not helped either.
Let's go to the text line, see if we can squeeze in a couple of messages, people who are needing some advice. Dr. Waleed, E saying, my daughter's been losing a lot of weight in very little time. I'm very concerned. She doesn't like talking about it, very defensive when her father and I try to ask her. We just don't know how to approach the matter without making it worse. I think that is going to perhaps resonate with an awful lot of people so much about wanting to broach it, but not wanting to frighten someone, to alarm them, to alert them, and perhaps that lead to them hiding behaviours or traits that you might have picked up on. How on earth do you start to broach this in a way that will get someone help if they need it?
Oh, dear. I mean, thoughts are with that family. It is a very difficult position to be in. And on one hand, you know, you're wanting to care for, you're really concerned, and you're wanting to raise that issue. And on the other hand, you don't want to, you know, disrupt any relationship, that little relationship that you have, that you can use while, you know, helping that young person. Now, I would say that, you know, first of all, you've got to remind yourself that eating disorder, you know, is a very serious illness. And the sooner that someone gets help, the higher the chances of recovery, the greater the chance of recovery. So, your time is ticking away. And so, you know, the sooner you act, the lots of patients and families that I've talked to during my time in UK, you know, breaking the silence has been one major factor for patients that has recognized that even at the time they didn't feel that was good. But, in retrospect, that was one of the biggest things that happened, the nicest things that happened for them. Mm-hmm. So breaking the silence and actually being more open about that. I would say that someone who is worried about someone, think about what you're going to say to the person. And it's more about listening than saying, perhaps, maybe. And you're just kind of maybe recognizing and maybe pointing out certain things that you notice. And maybe not going with a whole list of things that you notice, but that would mean that the young person might be feeling sort of watched or maybe the privacy invaded. But maybe taking one or two things and just talking about it. And maybe thinking maybe you're not the best person. Maybe thinking about who the young person maybe gets along well with, maybe are more likely to hear what you have to say, and maybe using that person in their life to open up that conversation. And again, reminding people it's not about the food and the weight, it's about feeling. So maybe checking in how they're feeling, more about listening to how they're going. And denial is so common, and I can completely identify with what those parents are saying. People will say there's nothing wrong with me, but it's sometimes maybe useful to just maybe some things, so you know, maybe things that you've noticed, and then maybe inquiring about that.
I think that's a really good point, because asking when you as a parent, you want everything to be okay, you want them to say I'm fine and there's nothing wrong, and there'd be a relief in hearing that. But I think those parental instincts often know more. Dr. Leed, I just want to put one question to you before we go to break, because it's really captured my attention and breaking my heart in honesty, something that's just come in on the text line, no name, saying, how do I maintain recovery when I miss my sick body? And I'm sure this is something that anyone who's been through any kind of eating disorder will understand, the truth in that there's, it's not just about the food, it's not about behaviours, it's often about the feelings, as you say. But how do I maintain recovery when I miss my sick body? How on earth do you begin to address that, Dr. Waleed? And I'm sorry, I wish we had more time for this, but what would you say to this listener?
I think many patients beat themselves up, really, you know, for not doing the right thing, not doing the right recovery, if you may, and compassion, just giving yourself, you know, that compassionate space to kind of forgive and to say that, you know, you're okay. And sometimes you got to keep trying and keep doing whatever you can to do the little thing that will help you feel better, to do the things that would keep you in recovery, and then not getting too, you know, sort of harsh on yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be one thing I would say, that, you know, someone who, you know, if they're really struggling, this person, they're saying that they missed their, sorry, I didn't quite catch the last thing.
He or she misses their sick body. So how they looked when they were in the depths of a disorder.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, we know that in eating disorders, people just lose touch with reality. I mean, people's perceptions of things are altered, and I think when they're reminded of something that is not true, and I think that it's very difficult, perhaps maybe in the moment to recognize that, but mm-hmm. you probably need to be in conversation with your therapist to kind of get into that conversation. But compassion, really being compassionate to yourself in the moment, is I think key to any hope of recovery.
I agree. Dr. Waleed, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. We had so many messages. It just goes to show there's an awful lot more people suffering or worrying than we perhaps had realised. We'd love to have you on a future show to address some of the themes that have come out on the text line today. Dr. Waleed can be found at Priory Wellbeing Centre in Abu Dhabi. Thank you to you, sir. Have a great day ahead.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
great to have you with us and taking a look at child psychology this half hour. And unfortunately, more children are self-harming since the start of the pandemic. A study published in December 2020 found children as young as primary school age are harming themselves intentionally, and it's on the rise. So what are the warning signs that we as parents need to look out for? And ultimately, what can we do to help? To offer some insights and advice is Masha Kalusa Valkanu, a psychologist and psychotherapist with more than 13 years of clinical experience. She is at Thrive Wellbeing Centre, specialised in working with adults, youth, children and families. And she is on hand. So please do get in touch on 4001 or indeed the ARN Play app if any of these topics raises questions or red flags with you. You can be totally anonymous. It really doesn't make any difference to me at all. Masha, thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Helen. Thank you very much for having me. Well, I'm great.
Thank you for being with us. It's not a pleasant topic, and one that I know no parent out there wants to be confronted by or have to notice warning signs or have these conversations with our children. But as I said, self-harm is on the rise, and I'm a firm believer that forewarned is forearmed, and we need to be aware of what we're looking for so we can ultimately help our children. So I'd love you, if you don't mind, to start with the basics. For anyone who's not familiar with the phrase self-harm or don't really understand what it is, how do you define it? How do you explain what self-harm is, Masha?
Sure. So, first, yes, it is much more common than we usually think. So maybe 10% of children are self-harming at some point in their lives, which means if you have a classroom full of children, like around 30, that means that probably you will have one or two children that had experienced self-harm somewhere down the timeline of their teenage years or their adolescence. So with COVID or with any stress increased, we of course have this behavior also increased as well. Self-harm is maybe intuitively people understand that it means some kind of behavior which is just directed towards hurting yourself. It's usually done by burning your skin or cutting your skin, but widely it is any kind of risky behavior that can actually lead to harming physically yourself. Self-harm behavior doesn't have to be linked to that at all, but we always have to be careful and to, you know, have our red flags raised and pay attention. So regarding your question, how do parents or teachers, counselors in school recognize this kind of behavior? First, you of course, as a parent, should follow your child with your parental intuition, let's say. Especially during stressful times, so when there is some kind of tense situation in the house, moving, especially some traumatic events for children or anything, just watch more closely your children. If you notice that the child is more into themselves, more searching through the internet, though that is really not something we can differentiate, but maybe sometimes peek to their search history. And then if they're insisting on wearing long sleeves or hiding from you in the bathroom so that you never get to see them more or less naked, just pay attention, because maybe it's about hiding some scars.
Masha, I'm just curious, Masha, if it's when we talk about self-harming behavior, is it sometimes a one-off or is it usually a repeated behavior?
Mm-hmm. Self-harm is very addictive behavior. So yes, it can be one-off, but usually, unfortunately, it is not. Mm-hmm. Because self-harm is aimed, its goal is to reduce emotional tension. So it's very good in doing so, while it's really what my clients used to say. Usually they say, I feel so horrible, I'm so sad, I'm so angry, I don't control anything in my life. And then I just don't know what to do from this frustration and anger. And then when I make a cut, when I see blood, when it hurts, I feel like my inner pain is getting more numb. I can feel the pain that is real on my skin, and I feel more calm inside. But unfortunately, this lasts for very, very few moments. So after that, we usually experience more shame, more guilt, more regrets, and then this opens a new wave of psychological tension that can also lead to the cycle and repeating the cycle. Usually there are a few days or maybe a few weeks that a child feels more at ease, but then it starts all over again. And a child can recognize the triggers very often, and maybe, you know, sooner or later we come to the point that we can discuss this. So what I think it's very important here is that we encourage children or teenagers or adolescents to talk about it. We encourage them to open up. It may be a friend or a family member for the start. It can be a trusted teacher or a counselor at school. But what is the most important is that at the end, the only help that is needed is the help from a psychotherapist who has to work with that child for a prolonged period of time.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Psychologist and psychotherapist Masha Valkanu is with us from Thrive Wellbeing Centre this afternoon as we have a special look at self-harm, sadly in the light of these numbers, these case numbers, reported numbers that we know of rising during the pandemic. Of course, I'm sure, Masha, the unreported cases and those that we simply don't know about have increased even more. And I wanted to go to the text line 4001 to see if you can help this parent, saying, my young teen has been self-harming for a year or so. It took a long time for me to notice. Seemed like just picking a scab to start, but I finally twigged about 6 months ago. The pattern is I notice, she stops for a while, she starts again, I notice. Usually just picking at skin, but I've noticed some long, very thin cuts, very light and surface, but obviously self-harming. I'm petrified that if I push too hard, it'll become even more hidden or secret. I've got no idea how to deal with it. She point blank refuses to discuss it in any way, and I'd love some advice. No name, please. Masha, I think that really echoes, you know, you were talking earlier about the importance of a young person being able to talk to somebody. This is obviously a very concerned and loving parent who wants to talk, but that young teen is just shut down. How on earth can we advise on how to proceed on what sounds like a really worrying situation?
Yes, that is exactly what I wanted to say. We do motivate young people to talk about it, but what is actually more important and what we should educate people more is about how to react if the child comes to us, or in this case, if a parent sees that something is clearly wrong. So what is the most important is that reaction in the first moment that should be extremely simple. No big thoughts, nothing wise, nothing from the other side of the earth. It is just pure showing non-judgment and empathy. That are only two things that we should communicate to that child. This is okay. I guess you're going through some very hard stuff. I guess you're going through a hard period. I'm here to help. I'm in your team. I'm your friend. I can offer you support. Please, whenever you find that you are ready to talk to me, I'll be here. Also, this mom is saying that she doesn't know if she can push too much. I think it's very good to communicate this to the child exactly like that. Listen, I love you so much. I don't know what to do. I'm afraid to push you. Also, I'm afraid to brush this under the carpet. Please help me to help you. Mm-hmm. But at the end, what is the most important is the parent is here, how to say, the parent has all the power in the world regarding the future of the child, because the parent is the one who is paying for therapy, who is taking the child to therapy, and who is ensuring that the child endures in therapy. But from the other hand, the parent is completely without power, because there is nothing that the parent can say or do to stop this from going on. So the main task is to get your child to the therapy.
I agree. I think, unfortunately, for a lot of parents, admitting that your child has a problem can feel like a failing on their part, and there can be a huge amount of denial involved in, you know, saying my child needs mental health support, and how does that reflect on me as a parent? How have I failed them? And unfortunately, that's an obstacle that a lot of people face, either consciously or subconsciously. And Masha, I really wish we had some more time to delve into this, but unfortunately, we don't. We'd love to discuss this further. We have had a number of messages just wanting to share support and what they've been through. So thank you for your honesty. Masha, you can be found at Thrive Wellbeing Centre. So if this has raised any red flags and someone is looking to get some help, either for them or for someone in their life, please don't hesitate. As we said, Masha is a specialist psychologist and psychotherapist who works with adults, youth, children and families. Masha, thank you so much for your time.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We love shining the spotlight on inspirational young people, whether that is through charity endeavours, academics, athletics, or just something that makes them special. So please, if there's anyone that springs to mind as I say that, get in touch with us now on 40801. Speaking to one right now, Yuna Zakakov is with us, a Year 13 student at Jess, who's about to undertake something that most fully grown, fully trained adults would be quaking in their boots at. He's going to be undertaking the Marathon de Sable next month, that famous ultra marathon, 250 kilometres across the Sahara Desert, and raising money for charity. Yuna, thank you so much for being with us today, taking time out of studying and no doubt training. You're on the countdown. How does it feel to have this event just around the corner?
I'm actually really anxious right now because the race is about to start in 11 days. So I'm in a preparation and a final preparation season. Mm-hmm. So I'm packing my backpack, getting ready both physically and mentally, and trying my best to manage all my schoolwork as well.
Oh my goodness. You're a maniac, but you're doing this for a good cause. Now, I can kind of sympathize to some extent because I'm leaving to climb Kilimanjaro on the 1st of October, and I'm the same. Like, my floor is just covered with my backpack. I'm listening to motivational TED Talks. I'm meditating. I'm packing, like, the snacks and thinking about, well, how my feet are going to be. How long has this been in the planning? When did you first get this idea?
So we got an idea with my dad. It was at the beginning of the year, if not mistaken. So we were just doing our morning running, and my dad came with the idea to do this race. He asked me out, like, do you want to do it? And I said, can I answer you at the evening? So I went to school. I started to do the research, searching for the race, the pros and cons of participating in it. And at the end of the day, I thought, like, why not? It's such an adventure.
It is an adventure. Now, 250 kilometres across the Sahara Desert. What are the logistics around training for this? I mean, we're lucky that we're in Dubai and that you've got somewhat similar terrain to train on. But what's that schedule been like for you?
So, yeah, living in Dubai, it's a perfect opportunity to train, because we have pretty much the same climate and the terrain as well. We have both the mountain and the dunes. In terms of training, I was trying to schedule my training either before or after school, because the school is still a priority for me. Usually, I was doing the training after school, and it starts at 7 and ends pretty much at 10, because I was doing both the running and strength and conditioning work to improve my physical ability and my endurance.
What? And how do you feel the training's going? I mean, do you get up to 250 kilometers in your training, or what's the furthest distance you're going to do?
So we started with 5 kilometer runs, and we gradually increased it up to 10. Then we've done 15, 21, 25, 30, 35. Then we've done a marathon, and the longest distance that I've ever done it was 50 kilometers in one go.
And what's it going to look like in terms of how many days are you going to be doing the Marathon du Sable on across?
So the Marathon du Sable is a 6 days, 6 day multi-stage self-sufficient ultramarathon. So basically you have a backpack that you pack with the food for 6 days, your kit, your equipment, clothes, any other extra, we call them luxuries. And yeah, that's pretty much it. The only thing that the organizers are providing us with is water and a shelter to sleep.
So you've got to carry all your kit for the full 6 days. So you're talking about the running training, but you're talking about strength and conditioning there. What's the weight of your pack going to be?
So the weight of the pack is going to be between 12 and 15 kilograms. I'm really hoping that at the end, it's going to be something like 12, because carrying it, all this stuff across the desert, it's not an easy thing to do. And yeah.
Okay. Now, you're not just doing this to, you know, say you've done it and achieve something incredible. You're doing this for charity as well, Yuna. Tell us a little bit about the cause that you're running for.
So recently, I became a trustee of the Artohai district of the Karaganda region in Kazakhstan. And now I'm starting to raise funds for the selection stages for admissions to the Aiknath High School for students in rural regions. And the collected funds will enable 286 students of rural schools to receive a high-quality education in Kazakhstan.
Amazing. That's amazing. How much money are you looking to raise then?
So it's going to be around 25,000 dirhams.
Wow, that's incredible. Huge congratulations on
thank you
on having that focus, and I'm sure that's what's going to keep you going. And how's your dad feeling after he suggested this and now he's sending his boy off to the desert?
He's feeling really good because both of us are doing the race. We're doing this together.
Amazing.
And that's one of the advantages, I would say, of running. Because it became our same interest. We have the same interest in sports. So he suggested running, and we started to train and run together. And by creating this goal to do the Marathon du Sable, we started to train together, and it helped us to get to know each other much better. And we spend a lot of time together, so which is really cool.
So it's changed your relationship a bit.
Yeah. Definitely.
And talk to me about logistics. You're talking about luxuries there. You know, what are you going to be packing as your luxuries?
So, as my luxuries is probably going to be the pillow.
That's a really tragic luxury. That a pillow is a luxury. Oh,
yeah.
Bless you. But you can't, if you're not sleeping well, how can you perform the next day? So that makes sense to me. Are you taking like a foam one or like an inflatable one? What are you thinking?
I'm taking the inflatable one because I don't have that much space in my backpack because we were trying to pack it with the food and it's kind of full. So we don't really have that much space. So we looking both at the space it takes and the weight of the item.
I had a real low point yesterday when looking at my backpack, and I decided to snap my toothbrush in half so it wouldn't take up so much space.
Yeah, that's what we do. That's just a lifestyle of backpackers, I think.
And what about food? I kind of think about as if you're going to space, you know, when you think about you've got to be getting some really high calorie, but, you know, not so heavy things to take with you. What are you going to be eating over the course of a day?
So we're taking a freeze-dried food, which is like really expensive ramen noodles, I'd say. So it's really light in weight. It's around 100 or 130 grams. And contains more than 500 calories, which is a really good ratio. Also, we're taking some bars, energy bars, gels. There's a drink called Soylent for our recovery. Taking some nuts, seeds, some dried fruits, and our national food called Kurt.
What's that? This is from Kazakhstan.
So basically it's a fermented milk, and you leave it on the sun, and it becomes like a brick, and then you put it in your mouth, and it's like it's really salty, so it helps to balance the salts and the minerals in the body while you do the running or any other endurance things.
I am so in awe of what you're doing. I really, really am. And weirdly, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and it featured a Swedish ultramarathon runner who did the Marathon de Sable, in her words, first time for recreation. Second time she did it was to see how fast she could do it. She ended up winning, and she had one song on repeat. I think it was Carly Simon, Let the River Run, which kind of kept her going over the last few kilometers. Are you going to be listening to anything, do you think?
I started to create a playlist of different music and podcasts, and hopefully it's gonna help me to do the run. And the way we're using the music is like a doping. Mm-hmm. So it basically we run as much as we can, and then when we feel really tired or really down, we just put the music on, and it helps us to run, to start running again.
Give you that boost.
And continuing the race, yeah.
Yes. Good. All right. So we're on the countdown. 11 days. what does the next 10 days look for you in terms of prep? I mean, for me, it's about let's not get sick, let's not get injured before we go. What about you?
It's pretty much the same thing. We're waiting for the visa from the Moroccan embassy. We're getting a second shot of vaccine tomorrow, mm-hmm. For the race, and just in general, we finalizing all the backpack equipment, all the items that we're taking. We have some new things that we're taking as the flags, different flags. The reason why we're taking different flags is because by running this ultramarathon, I'll become the youngest participant from Kazakhstan, as well as the youngest participant as a UAE resident.
Oh, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. And I'm trying to be quite stoic about this. I'm like, if I don't summit Kilimanjaro, I just really want to be there to enjoy the nature and time with people, and I'm trying to not let my ego get in the way. How do you feel about, you know, the possibility of not finishing it?
I'll really try my best to do it, even if it's gonna cost me afterwards. Mm-hmm. But if I'll get unlucky, then I'll probably just come back the other year on the other edition of Marathon des Sables and finish it. I'm really going there just to enjoy the race, because at the beginning we were thinking to get in the top 100, and unfortunately at the beginning of summer I got injured. And about like 2 months ago, I was walking. I couldn't walk. I was just jumping with the crutches. And now I'm in an active recovery stage. And hopefully nothing from the injury will come back to me on the race day.
The adrenaline will kick in. The adrenaline will kick in and keep you going. And as you say, you might be a broken man at the end of it, but just keep running. You know, how can anyone follow your progress, whether that's your training? I know there might not be much Wi-Fi during Marathon de Sable, but when you get back to see how you get on, how can we follow that journey?
So you can follow on my Instagram page. I set it up an Instagram page, and I'm posting stories every day showing the training process, the packing, and everything. And I'll be posting over there. Hopefully, we will get a Moroccan SIM card with the data on it, and if I'm gonna get really lucky, I can post all the way from the Saharan Desert so people could see their progress.
Amazing. So what's the account?
The account is _shinyman_.
Amazing. All right, I am on it. Going to be following you and cheering you the whole time. Huge congratulations, Ina. I think it's absolutely incredible what you're doing. Get that Jess flag flying high, Kazakh flag, UAE flag, you and your dad with big smiles at the finish line, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Have a good one. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune into Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.